What a passage. Are you a sheep or are you a goat? Big choice. As Barbara mentioned in starting, this is the last Sunday in this church year. So we're in a tradition which still holds on to the high Middle Ages just a little bit. And church year finishes today. And it's been a year where we've gone through the Gospel of Matthew. Now, Matthew is a tough gospel. And I've mentioned before, but it's associated with a group of Christians who were under pressure. And when people are under pressure, they see things in more black and white terms. You know? The higher brain functioning, the mammalian brain and the snake brain. Somewhere in that, things get severe, they get intense. And this passage fits perfectly into that. This is Judgment Day. And the fires of hell are the background. There are sheep, there are goats. This is not a reading that fits well into a warm, fuzzy world of fluffy ducks. This is not the reading for the Sunday school picnic. This is stern stuff. And again, it reflects, these aren't sort of just, you know, academic theologians wafting around having high thoughts about Jesus and eternity and things like that. No, this is, wow. This is the Middle East. This is cheek to jowl. This is the synagogue of the Messiah and the other synagogue, all in the same street. And there's tension. So judgment is depicted very clearly and very severely. And we have a Jesus who is king. Not just the sort of nice guy that, you know, girls might bring home to meet their mother, or you know, someone who's gentle with furry animals and children, meek and mild. No, this is Jesus as Lord. And this is what's going to happen that day. So I've been meditating on this passage for some years. And I've been thinking in the last week, where does it connect with St. Matthew's, us here this morning? So some of you are guests, you walked in, you'll make your own connections in terms of your own experience and your own background and maybe your own home church. So I'm going to tell a story and have a discussion, 2 points to make. Let's start for story first. There was a monastery, a monastic community, and I've had the privilege of staying in several of these sorts of communities in Europe. And like many of the communities, in this case, it's a male one, the number of brothers is in decline. So they had this monastic complex, a large church, nave, and a choir for the monks. And they lived their life. And they wake up at midnight and 4 a.m. does exist, people. 4 a.m. is there. And they wake up again at 8. They chant the psalms. And in the afternoon, they do practical work. Brother Euphonius looks after the bees. Brother Michael is raising rabbits, and so on and so on. And like a lot of monastic communities, on Sunday, their worship is open to the local village for all comers. And you can, the townsfolk can come and find a place in the church. This building has faint echoes of that tradition. That's where the monks would have sat, up there, possibly behind a screen. So they're doing their thing, but everyone else may come and take in the glass windows while you're at it. So it's that sort of world. Now, things are not going well in this monastery. As I've said, they're in decline. And if you go to these monasteries, often you see a lot of very, very senior men and one or two young recruits, novices, who somehow find their way there. They're the next generation, but it's only one or two of them. And morale is dropping. And being people, they're doing people stuff. And the environment starts to degrade. It's heading towards toxic. Yes, they're monks, men of God. We pray 5 times, 6 times a day. And consequently, the townsfolk sense this. And it's not such a sweet place to be on Sunday morning. So attendance kind of dribbles away. And it gets to the point where the 5 monks are by themselves. And they're doing their people stuff. One of them decides, look, I'm not going to just do things because he says so. You know, he might be the abbot here, but stuff him. And another one, others are telling little stories, and there's gossip, and there's 2 groups. One of them, even in a night of desperation, hits the communion wine. Things are going bad. There are a couple of occasions where, while we're worshiping, one of them has a hissy fit and raises his voice and storms out. The others just look at each other. Oh, he's a bit like that. He'll calm down. So you get the scene. This is not edifying. This is not good. So they're part of a greater order. And a brother, one of the leaders of the order, is sent out there and comes to be with them. And he sits with them and he prays with them and shares meals with them. And the question is, well, should we just shut down? You know, hand our buildings to a worthy cause and we'll just go to another house. And when we pass away, we'll join the other brothers in the graveyard at the back of the monastery. Usually rows of humble grey stone crosses over there. And the director general of the order is a very wise cookie. And he sits down with them before he goes. He says, I only have one thing to say to you. One of you is the Christ. One of you is the Christ. There's silence. And he walks out and leaves them. The 5 brothers are left there sitting to reflect on this. One of us is the Christ. Which one? Is it Brother Euphonius? Brother Michael? Can't be Brother Michael. Maybe Brother Brian. One of us is the Christ. And it straight away generates the awareness that they could be mistreating or abusing the Christ without knowing it. What would a wise person do? You don't know who it is. But our superior general has told us one of us is the Christ. They're serious men. They're not happy. They're not healthy. But they're serious men. And so the conclusion is reached. If one of us is the Christ, maybe we should treat all well. And it starts to grow. They start to treat each other as if the other were the Christ. And quite quickly, there's a transformation. The air sweetens. Peace comes. For some reason, one or two of the townsfolk come, ostensibly maybe to show off the architecture or see some stained glass window. But they notice what's happened here. The air has sweetened. It's not like it was. And they whisper that to their neighbour over the fence one day. Oh, I was up at the monastery, you know. It's not as grim as it was. I might chance it again on a Sunday. And they do. And another does. And the Sunday community starts to grow. Meanwhile, the brothers are still wondering, who is the Christ among us? But hedging their bets by treating all with the love and the grace and the honour that they would extend to the Christ. Stories have their own richness. The reason I share that story is because the basic problem in the story that Jesus told about Judgment Day in his conversation with both the righteous and the unrighteous is they didn't recognize him. Whether they fed him and met him in prison and tended to his needs, or whether they had pretended he wasn't there and not done so, even unto the least, neither of them recognized Christ in those they had cared for or neglected to care for. The story is pointing to a failure to recognize Christ. We believe that all are made in the image of God. Jews and Christians believe that. Don't think other religions do, because they don't. But because of that, if we recognize that thumbprint, that hallmark of the Creator in others, it guides our, it sets our ethical compass, it steers us in how we will treat and relate to other people. But you have to recognize it. There are powerful mechanisms at work, even here in New Zealand, to try and prevent people recognizing that. Powerful word for this is to demonize, to say, no, they are not worthy of my love. No, they are not human. No, they are not. And then terrible things happen. First they burn the books, and then they burn the people. So recognizing the Christ, or even the imprint of the Creator, his image, in each and every person is so important. And on Judgment Day, it will be an issue. So that's the story. And then I want to have a discussion. It is the day of Christ the King. Now, I've had a joke at Americans' expense before. Are there any Americans here this morning? Okay. So I have many fine American friends and colleagues, and words are important. One of the words that a lot of Americans don't like is the kingdom of God. Now, I've mentioned this before. They had a war of independence where they fought very hard to get rid of one George III. And they're very proud of that. They don't like kings. And so they rebrand the scriptural term as the commonwealth of God. Maybe very right of center people might say the corporation of God. I've heard some say the administration of heaven. Now, it's trying to get around something. It's trying to get around something. So I'm having a bit of a giggle here at American language. It's easy to do. Now let's talk about New Zealand. I don't know if you're all resident in New Zealand, but sociologists would say New Zealand has a fairly flat social structure. I heard the phrase, I think it was from you, Chris, a few weeks ago. A typical New Zealand idea is Jack's as good as his master. It's an ingrained thing because people got on leaky boats to come here to get away from the squire and the vicar and all that nonsense. And yet it's fun when they come over here for a day or two and people like to pretend there are kings and dukes and queens, but go back on the boat, go away. Because we like to have this horizontal, flat society. So I've just lived in the Netherlands for 18 years, which is not only geographically flat, but equally has a flat social structure. It's a point where the two cultures connect. In contrast to other European societies, which have a very stratified, vertical, know your place in the scheme of things. So some are happy with there being people of higher status, and others, no, it's level playing field, and if you stick your head out, be it a poppy or whatever, you may lose it. It's a powerful, powerful dynamic. Just recognize that about ourselves in New Zealand. We don't like this sort of thing. So I remember growing up and a proud claim was, the Prime Minister's phone number is in the phone book. You know, or the Dutch version of this is, the Prime Minister arrives by push bike at The Hague. You know, he does, yes, he arrives, goes to work by bike. And it was quite a funny thing. You'd see the American motorcade with, you know, bulletproof vehicle and all the accompanying vehicles arriving, and there was a Dutch Prime Minister came on his bike. Because it's flat. Don't try and pretend that you are something more. Okay, that's what it is. That's the water we swim in. Now we're celebrating Christ the King. Now I'm leading to something here. We're not well equipped for handling or for relating to greatness. What was the first creed of the early church? This is a Sunday school question. You'll get a gold star for this. Does anyone know what the first creed of the early church was? It's in the Bible. Man, you get the gold star and a gold and a chalky fish. That's it, yes. Jesus is Lord. If there's ever a power statement, that's it. The word Lord doesn't sit well in English today. Some of us have landlords. It's a weird term, isn't it? Are there any other places where Lord is still seriously applied? The courts? Okay. My Lord. What was that? So again, it brings home to us, we're not culturally equipped to handle the rock that is higher than us. Maybe Maori are equipped to recognize mana and honor it as such. Now we like things flat. That's reflected in many ways. So back to the early church. First creed, Jesus is Lord. Now, once it broke into the Roman world, that became an issue. Does anyone know why the Christians were persecuted and then fed to the lions and such? What was the actual reason? Was it? Thank you. And you can't have two lords, can you? No. So the official dogma was Caesar is Lord. That's how you did it. And that sort of grew, and Caesar became divine. Son of some god. And the whole kind of social and political structure got kind of pivoted on this point. Caesar is Lord. And Caesar's greatest claim was to have established peace. That around the Roman Sea, around the Mediterranean, there was peace. And there were roads. You know? Some of you may think of Monty Python at this point. What have the Romans ever done for us? Well, this was their biggest claim. They brought peace. Jesus is Lord, and the Prince of Peace was a direct counter to that. And out of that phrase, Jesus is Lord, every aspect of Christian faith and practice flows. Jesus is our great one. And it's both subjective and objective. It's objective in the sense that who Jesus is, what he has done, places him in the highest place. He has ascended and is at the right hand of the Father. He has triumphed over sin and death. He has been risen from the dead. Beat that, Muhammad. That's the objective. That's the gospel. And then there's the subjective. Jesus is my Lord. It's now personal. I'm just waving someone in. Jesus is my Lord. And in today's world, you can claim whatever Lord you want. That's your personal business. That's very nice for you, people will say. I'm very happy for you, very condescendingly. But the minute you claim something objective, something with muscle and teeth that's going to change the world, every despot and dictator and tyrant will get uncomfortable because they don't like competition. So that's the objective side of it. So I'm exploring this, what it means to have Christ as King, Jesus as Lord. Now, to bring it into the room here, Christianity is not just sort of something that's lived between our ears or internalized in our heart, like something we carry within us. It's something we live. It's something that is enacted. It is something that is incarnated, to use a big word. Incarnated, given substance, given form, given hands and feet. As long as Christianity is internalized and is a me and God thing and a personal, private spirituality, the world can't care less. You know, what you do in the privacy of your own self, in your home, or in these designated spaces on Sunday, whatever. People are doing all sorts of things all over the place. But the minute we start to incarnate it, to live it, to engage it with what is around, then the music starts. Then it gets interesting. So my question to us, and it is a question to think about, is how do we, however you describe yourself, whatever cultural reference you run with, how do we express, reflect, let it be known that Jesus is Lord? Now, one track this line of thinking might run along is honor and respect. Honor and respect. If you are from a shame honor culture, this is obvious. You're really tuned to the whole kind of outworking of showing honor or showing disrespect. You get it. If you're not attuned to a shame honor culture, then this is a bit foreign. The business of showing respect, of showing honor. How do you do that? Jesus told stories about the seating arrangements at wedding feasts. Who got the best seat? You mean there is a best seat? All seats aren't alike? All seats aren't equal? No, they're not. There are best seats. And his advice to his followers was, take the bottom one, and then it'll be up to someone else to promote you. No, don't sit there. Come here. It's a bit like being on a plane and being shunted up to first class. Yeah, there is a first class. Yeah, it's not all economy. Or did they not tell you that? This business of showing honor and respect, how do we do it? We could get interactive on this, but it's best for us just to think about it. Well, I'll just open up one area, how we dress. Now, far be it from me to suggest anything about what people should or should not wear. I'm not that stupid. But I do think it is a way that we show honor or choose not to show honor to others. And again, if you're from an honor-shame culture, you get this. This is obvious. If you're not from an honor-shame culture, you'll think, get real, get off the grass. So, I didn't know how I was going to finish this sermon, but I know now, it's just landed on me. The honor that Jesus wants is, as Amos prophesied two Sundays ago, I think. He wants righteousness. He wants justice to flow. He wants us to do right and to honor others as if they were him. That's what he wants. It's all about people. It's so close. Ko te mea nui, he tangata, he tangata, he tangata. It's that far from Jesus. The way we treat others, recognizing them as God's creations, as Christ among us, that's the honor he wants. Now, if you're in a culture where, especially among men, the way to relate is, well, you take the mickey out of each other and you knock each other and you're like puppies in a litter and you just squabble and bite and carry on. And it's all fun. Keep the stress low and just race to the bottom on everything. This is quite a shift. How do I move from that to honoring someone? How do I move from that to taking them seriously, to blessing them as a child of God, as a reflection of God, of Christ among us? How do we do that? Again, that's the culture, that's what church is about. This is the place to learn that. This is the place to practice that. This is our calling. This is where Jesus is going on Judgment Day. And to the least. Not those sitting at the top table, but to the least. And so here it is, to put it all together. We recognize and truly honor the greatness of our King, Christ as King, Jesus as Lord, in the way we treat each other. And the world is not going to teach us how to do that. The world is not going to teach us how to do that. That's what we have to learn in church. That's what we have to practice, and that's what we have to develop. And like those monks, when we even get 10 cents worth of that, those around smell the difference. So it was said of the early Christians, by outsiders, see how they love one another. Irenaeus, one of the church fathers, noted this. Because the love that comes from being loved in God through Christ and then recognizing and honoring Christ in others, even the least, is something the world just cannot mimic or do. It is unique. I went for a run this morning. I like Sunday morning because the traffic levels are low and the air is cleaner in Kaikarai Valley. And at this time of year, the air is not only clean, but I run past a flowering bush or a garden, and some scent just fills my awareness for a few meters. And sometimes I stop and I think, where's that coming from? That's akin to being among people in a sweet place and stopping and thinking, what is this? Who are these people? Such like. That fragrance of is both Christ among us and manifesting in ways that others can recognize and can't mimic. So Christ the King, not just the liturgical full stop at the end of the church's year, not just, nice theme. It wasn't hard to choose hymns on this, was it, Megan? No, it's core business, it's stirring stuff. I'm going to tease you a little bit here, Megan, but the British in particular like writing hymns about monarchy, don't they? Yeah, it's one of these things where kind of theology and you know, the political order sort of dovetail quite nicely. Americans don't write hymns about that. Okay. It's not that. It gets to the core of it. And coming right into the room here, how we behave, how we relate, is part of this. And now to scare you, it's judgment day business. Jesus is very interested in this. And I humbly suggest that our homework, and not just us, but our homework as Christians, is to grow in the wisdom and the love and the freedom to love, care, and honor each other as Christ among us.